Susquehanna and the surrounding areas had many a blacksmith down through the years to provide much-needed services for the local farmers and householders. One that many remember is the late Jimmy Laughlin, who operated first at Balla and later Kirkery. Jimmy's son Ted shares some of the stories and memories from his father's long blacksmithing career.
He was born in Balla, East Galway. He served his time as a blacksmith in Dolly's Forge in over between Munavee and Minla. And then he had a small little place in Balla doing a small amount of work. He got married and built his own little place there. Started up a little business for all the locals.
So he sets up his own forge. He has done an apprenticeship, so I wonder how long it takes to kind of learn the tools of the trade for a blacksmith.
Probably you never learn with a horse, because you have different challenges every day, different temperament in horses, and I suppose normally 5 years now, I would say, for an apprenticeship, but I'd say it could take 10 years, you know, in dim times.
TJ Scanlon, whose grandfather ran McDonough's Forge in Killescope, had a few more details about Jimmy Laughlin's early career as a blacksmith.
He trained over in Caltra in Kilcommonses. And I know there was another individual with them from Mindler, this part of the world, and I can't remember his name, but the two of them trained together. And Jimmy then moved to Mead, and he went into a smithing business in Mead, working for the smith. And I remember some 20 years later, I presume, Jimmy and myself went up to Mead and we called to the very same men who were looking for to buy a binder at the time. And Jimmy was of the opinion that if there was anyone in the area, this man would know where it was and he'd be able to tell us. So we called there, but we weren't lucky enough to find what we were looking for, but a lovely man.
Tell me a little bit about the kind of jobs that your dad would have been doing as the village blacksmith.
Oh, he would be shoeing all the, we'd say, the horses for the locals in the ploughing season, we'd say, for potatoes and sown corn, fixing machines in the line of grubbers, harrows, ploughs, keeping them repaired, keeping them going.
Because we're talking about probably the years, the 40s, the 50s and 60s. So the horse would have been the tractor, the equivalent of the modern day tractor for those farmers in those times. So he would have been very busy.
Oh, very busy. And he had a small farm as well. And he was to-ing and fro-ing, and those days, there was queues outside the door with horses, and there was no phones at the time. So it was all word of mouth, and could take a day to do one job, and they'd be talking about olden times and joking and all this sort of stuff.
Paint a picture for me, if you will, Ted. We were talking before we started recording here about what you remember as a young boy going into your dad's workshop. Can you paint a picture for the listener from the moment you went in the door?
I was told in the line of the bellows that if I leaned too hard on the bellows at the time, that the fire wouldn't kindle or heat right. So it was a slow process. I tried shoeing a horse a few times, but to no avail. So I said that wasn't for me. But I seen the other side, like it was hard work on his behalf. A lot of mad horses as well.
And explain to me how the system worked for getting the fire and everything hot enough so that the metal could be bent.
Well, you had a big bellows, I'd say, shaped like all I can describe it as a fiddle, with a pipe off it, came out through the wall and came in around into a boiler, which would have two pipes off it to keep the pipe from getting corroded from the coal. But in them times, there was no chimney in the forge, so it would take probably half an hour to get the heat to where you wanted to heat the shoe. And you'd have to they need no put in the shoe, and while you'd be putting on one shoe, you'd have the other shoe on heating, shaping it up for the horse's foot.
So the conditions within in the forge, it must have been extremely hot and smoky as well, I'd imagine.
Oh, you'd be as black. There wasn't a lot of water at the time either, so you'd be very, very colourful when you'd be finished. But saying that, cold water was the job at the time, and soap, the red soap, carbolic, I think to call it. So use that, and everything was, I didn't see anybody getting sick after it, like nowadays. So he lived until 84, 85 years of age, so I don't think the blacksmith killed him.
But you were saying to me that there was an asbestos roof on the forge as well, so it was tough conditions to be working in day in, day out.
Well, that was the general, all forges at that time had asbestos roofs, as long as you didn't touch them. Or it was nice and cosy and warm, and it never dripped, like it was non-drip, and there wasn't an issue that time over asbestos, but nowadays it's totally different.
Your dad would also be making other items apart from shoeing horses as well. He was a very skilled blacksmith.
He came up with an idea in the earlier years before these big power harrows came in. He used to make, he came up with an idea that he could put a frame on a spring tooth harrow that you could put it on a tractor. And there was a great go on them. Actually, there's a few of them around all the time, if they could be traced down. But he was delighted with himself. He used to buy the pipes and board the pipes and put on the, buy the tines and fit the tines on the harrow, just for your depth when you'd be harrowing the field.
Where would he be getting supplies from then, like for when he would be making individual bits and pieces? Where did he have to source his supplies from that time?
There was a few different outlets. Lohan's in Minla was a kind of a hardware. I used to remember Sean Donoghue and Abin Achmai used to supply the nails, and he joked with him one time how he said if you could get them in Lohan's, you wouldn't have come over here for them. So Sean Donoghue would tell you that to the present day, what he did say, like, you know what I mean? And they'd have an old laugh afterwards and a joke, like.
To do him justice now would be something I I mightn't be able to do. But he was a nice individual. And he had a quick frame of mind. There's one thing that comes to mind. You heard of going to Crowpatrick and climbing it, and a number of the individuals here, they'd be cycling from here to Crowpatrick. And an uncle of mine, Paddy McDonough, cycled there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years or whatever, did it. And Jimmy was with them. And there was another individual who will remain nameless, but anyway, because he comes into the equation in another way. And just a funny story. They decided anyway they'd have a drink pretty near to Crowpatrick. I forget the name of the place. Patriella and Westport would be the three little towns on the way into Westport. And someone of those, anyway, they had gone into a pub there. And this individual, who will remain nameless, cast his elbow on the counter and he was looking somewhat upward, you know. And at that time, when you looked upward, you were looking at the best type of spirit, not stout or port or spirit, that was in the shop. And Jimmy took a look at him and he says, now listen here, he says, John or Joe, he says, you needn't be looking up there, he says, because I'm not buying any of that. So you can take it that Jimmy was witty. He was, and he didn't insult anyone. They all had a laugh at it, and so had the men who were looking up, because he wasn't even thinking that way, but that's the way that came out.
Now, you have something sitting here on the table in front of us. Will you explain to me what that is?
That's a stamp with his name on it. Dim Spring Harris at the time or whatever. He used to stamp his name on some things. I'm not 100% sure, but I think his name was put on some different bits and pieces.
He was working with fire, he was working with hot steel. Did your father have any serious incidents in the fort?
Yes, midway through the blacksmith career, I just vaguely remember one night. It was evening actually, not night, it was, I'd say, between 9 and 10 o'clock one night. He had this horse that he was shoeing, and people wouldn't, at the time they hadn't the money to replace the shoes, so the shoe was well worn at the time. And whatever happened on him, he was taking the shoe off or trying to remove it off the foot, and the horse gave a pull and cut him on his upper arm. There was a guy in the forge at the time, and he said, I'll bring you down to Dr. O'Burden. He said, down in Montpellier to get it stitched up, and there was no more about it next day. Just stitched up and job sound.
In terms of the area that your dad would have serviced, how far around would people have come to him in the forge?
I'd say could be 10 kilometres maybe of a radius. They came from My Law. They could have come from any given area at any given time. If somebody was stuck, we'd say had something broken, or a horse that a shoe fell off in the field, or just needed to get it done, and he would look after them the best he could.
Now, would your dad have done anything in terms of gates, or was it more farm machinery and the shoeing of the horses?
Not a whole pile on gates at the time, but a nod. He used to shoe wheels, the timber wheels. You'd have a bend on the timber wheel. I vaguely remember he done a few of them. You'd have the wheel left outside, you'd heat the bend, and you'd leave it on the wheel, and you'd pour cold water on the bend, and it would shrink into the wheel. I remember something on that, but not very much on that. But horses is the main thing that time, as far as I can remember at the time.
Now, you said the shoeing of the horses wouldn't have been for you. I suppose when people think of modern day farriers, you know, there's lifts, there's all kinds of accoutrements that help them to make the job easier. It wasn't the way for your dad. It was a very physical job to shoe a horse at the time, and you have a vivid memory of how it was done.
I tried it a few times myself, but no way. You have the horses behind you, his head is behind you, and he's looking at you. Sometimes, if you're removing a shoe from his foot, another thing as well, he was, if a horse had an ailment, he'd know straight away from the hoof that there was a problem there, and he could maybe rectify it. But I tried it a few times, trying to shoe a horse, but I couldn't hold the foot between my knees. Whatever way, there was a special way of doing it. So it was just a trade in itself, I think, myself.
He had physical strength then, obviously, though, to be able to do that.
Oh, yeah, he had a pair of hands in him like a shovel. But no, he was strong, very strong. He wasn't a heavy man or anything like that. And I remember they used to have aprons that time, and you wouldn't have 9 or 10 pences. But to save your pants, you'd have an apron and you'd turn it down between your two knees to save your pants from getting wore. So the clothes situation wouldn't be that plentiful at the time, like, but you'd try and spare your pants as long as you could, like. Then they had a stand as well, we'd say, for the big horses. I don't know, does every farrier have them nowadays, but it's a stand with three legs in it, and you could leave the horse's foot on the stand to finish off the shoeing of the horse, like, to make it. And he was always proud of the rasp. You'd run the rasp around the outside of the shoe to give it a nice finish. And some people used to put burnt oil on it, on the horse's hoof, you know, to make it presentable, like, even though he was going to be buried in clay in about an hour afterwards.
But he took a lot of pride in his work. So, I mean, he had his stamp for the things that he made from scratch, but obviously he put his own little touches as well when he was shoeing horses.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Even clinching the nails. You drive the nail through the hoof and you have to clinch it on the outside, because if you don't, the shoe would come off. There'd be nothing to hold the shoe from coming off. And you'd get a nice finish then with the rasp. You'd even the foot around level with the top of the shoe. And nine times out of ten, you'd have a toe as well turned up on the middle of the foot. And I also seen them as well, a horse that would be kind of wouldn't be running level, would say that the foot wouldn't be lying level on the ground. You'd have the shoe thicker on one side than the other. You could do that on the forge. You could thin it down one side and shape it to the horse's foot.
So there was a lot more to it than initially you would think.
Yeah, there was little things that made the job. You could stand back and have a look afterwards that at least it looked well when the job was done. But an awful lot of sweat involved as well. You know, you'd be after coming out of a hot fire and you'd be going in under a horse, and he might be sweating as well from being out on the field all day. And you'd see streaks on his face from the smoke of the sweat coming down and the smoke off the shed. And, you know, it was tough going.
Was there particular times of the year that were exceptionally busy for your dad there?
The climate was different in them years from what we're having now. There was less rain. So I'd say whenever the ploughing would take place, it would be to be more seasonable than now, the way things were falling that time. So there was always something. I'm sure people used the horses for different things as well. Like, you know, it wasn't all ploughing and tilling, and they were drawing water as well, we'd say, from wells, and the horse would be used on a regular basis.
Now, unfortunately, there aren't any photographs that we know of your dad at work in the forge, but you do have memories of visitors from overseas coming to see his work.
Yeah, there were in them times, the American tourists, and we had, there was a good few people that did reside in the parish at the time, and they used to love coming down, taking photographs of the fire, the bellows, even shoeing a horse, and he was over the moon over that, like, you know what I mean? And he said, they often said to him, that'll be an ornamental piece in America, the memories, like.
Talk to me about the latter years of your dad's career as a blacksmith. Did it get gradually quieter, I suppose, as the tractor and other machinery became more prominent on farms and maybe the horse less so?
Yeah, as time went on, it started to fizzle out a bit. But he still, up to 5 years before he passed away, he was still in the forge doing small bits and doing his own little thing, and he wasn't physically able to, he'd tell you, but he wasn't physically able to do anything with a horse. He had a little ass, a small ass that he used to have a cart on. He used to look after her, maybe he shod her a few times just to keep his mind at ease, and that was about it. He'd still potter around the shed, but he wasn't just physically able to do any more after that, like.
But after your dad passed away, you kept a lot of the items that he had used in his working life in the forge.
Yeah, I have an old vise, which is a blacksmith's vise, is the vise he had in the shed. I'd have a drill, I think, that he made up himself with a big wheel on it that takes, we'd say, the taper shank bits, that's what they call them. So that's done serious work in his heyday. That drill was always there. There was three windows in the forge. I can't understand why there weren't a fourth one. Probably it was too near the fire. But there was three windows, and they were replaced 20 years before he wound down. And the windows that went into it came out of the hospital in Manaslow. They were steel windows. I was actually working myself in the hospital in Manaslow painting, and they were giving away these windows, and they just fitted perfect in because the other ones were timber and they were gone rotten. So we fitted in windows, and he was over the moon over that as well at the time, like, do you know what I mean? And it was warmer as well, you know, you wouldn't have, the timber had gone rotten in the windows and made it cozier, like.
What's your most vivid memories of your dad, Ted, in that forge?
There was no panic on doing a job. We had a many row over the period of time. He'd wanted done his way, I'd wanted done my way. But at the end of the day, he reared us all with the money that he made. And we had good fun too. People have come up to me and that I knew your father from, he shot a horse for me. And I'd say he enjoyed the blacksmith that early years, but as time went on, he probably wasn't able to do what he was doing at the time, but he kept going.
But some of his skills would have passed on to the next generation to you.
Midway through, he had a gas welder and he had an arc welder. And that was a great thing. It was something you wouldn't be sledging a two-piece iron together, trying to stick them together. So you had this welder and it was a new, it was like a new black and white television, you know. So I took up that trade and I done an apprenticeship years later. He had taught me how to do it, like, at the time, like, so. And that welder then was traded to a fella and he bought a more modern one, because at the time, earlier on, that's when the electricity came in the shed. All they had was one bulb in the shed at the time, so you couldn't even see what you were doing some of the time, like, so. But it worked out okay. It worked out okay.
But it sounds like your dad was a man who wasn't afraid to move with the times. You know, he was able to adapt tools when the tractor came along, and he was able to adapt to the new tools when the new type welders came along as well.
Probably kept up with speed in that, because he knew there was potential there for welding and doing bits, making these grubbers that he started making. You needed a welder for them, for making up the frames. You couldn't weld on a horse shoe onto a horse, so it was no good there. So the welder was bought for specifically for welding them. And that's where I started off, smothering, I'd call it. But eventually I got the hang of it, and then I done the apprenticeship, and it helped me along the way, like.
And finally, Ted, it's an incredible thought to think that your dad has such a legacy that probably in many a farm shed around this parish and parishes beyond that, that there's possibly machinery in there that your dad made.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt. They have to be somewhere repaired, or, but there could be a lot of them gone too, because there was a lot of clubs down to the years was looking for donations of steel and all that, so they could be gone, and maybe the older generation probably wouldn't get rid of something like that. But
either way, he certainly made his mark in this community.
Oh yeah, in the generation before this, he was well known.
Is it sad to think maybe that his trade is kind of gone or has changed in such a dramatic way?
I wouldn't say it's gone, because you have plenty of horses in this country all the time, and you have farriers, mobile units shoeing horses, but they have a better setup. I don't mean that they have a handier life, but they have a better setup than he had. It was all a struggle in them years, like, you know, so they're keeping it going, but they have there's means and ways of doing it, but you still have to lift the foot.